Welcome to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLP 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And I've got two great radio hosts, and one of them is my co-host this evening, which is Lark in Texas, and the other one is Bruce G. McCarthy, and he's a former executive pilot and independent businessman from Maine. Since 1982, he has lectured nationwide on America's credit system. Having abandoned credit in all forms, Bruce and his wife, Jan, began developing a trade network to serve as a conduit for lawful trade and to assist the remnant's anticipated response to Revelations 18:4, "Come out of her, Babylon, my people." Now, Bruce, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I guess that'll work. that sounds all right. Yeah, I won't correct any of the details.
Okay, great. And say hi, Lark.
Well, hi there. Welcome, Bruce.
How are you doing, Lark?
Well, Bruce, I got an opportunity to catch you on Republic Broadcasting Network early one morning because you're up and on your program early Sunday mornings. So I sometimes leave my radio on overnight, and so that was how I had the opportunity to catch your program. Sometimes I have to searching on RBN and other networks to find people, but this way I found that it works very effectively for finding me. Oops. What happened, Lark?
Sorry about that.
Okay, so I found it an effective way for me to catch people that sometimes in trying to keep up with all the information and people that I want to listen to on internet and various other media, I found it to be an effective way to catch people. And since I did, I found your work to be very pertinent to what is going on in our economic system today, credit, debit, you name it. And I'm going to let you just kind of take it from there, and Lark and I will just kind of jump in when we think we find a question or two or something to add. So go ahead, Bruce.
Well, all right. First off, I guess you hit the nail on the head. It's a credit system. It's not a monetary system. I did begin lecturing on this subject back around 1979, 1980. I still do a little bit of that. And the subject matter that I dealt with was money, banking, and credit. Now, the United States does not operate on a monetary system, and we are not in a monetary crisis at the present time. The United States abandoned anything being used as money effectively in the 1960s. We have been approximately 50 years, almost a half a century, without any money. What we are in is a credit crisis. And most people keep using the wrong words. I know Lark is kind of a stickler for terminology. And we have basically been subverted by changing our language or manipulating our language. We still use the vocabulary of a monetary system which ended a half a century ago. And that vocabulary has been transferred over to a credit system. And people use the words the same way they used to use the words 50, 100, 200 years ago, as though there has been no difference, no change. But the changes have been phenomenal. And the only way to unravel the fraud and the mysticism of the credit system is to go back and define the words carefully. And you can find the truth if you have the vocabulary with which to find it. And unfortunately, we have a plethora, a host, an army of so-called monetary reformers out there today who are not monetary reformers at all. In fact, they think they're going to reform a monetary system, which they think we have right now under the Federal Reserve. And already they're running down the wrong road because we don't have a monetary system. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in a publication called Keeping Our Money Healthy, which was published back in 1977, said on page 12, quote, "And you recall, the Federal Reserve System works only with credit, period, end of story. It does not operate on money."
So in other words, we live on a slave plantation, and we're the slaves.
Yeah, you've kind of boiled it down rather quickly.
How about we live on a farm, and we're the farmed?
I would refer us back to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7, where King Solomon had said that the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is the servant to the lender. Now, if we break that verse down into its basic two components, the rich ruling over the poor, I have never heard of a situation where the poor people ruled over the rich. And I know there are a lot of communists out there, those who are active communists and don't mind the label, and there are those who are communists who are appalled by that label, but they're communists nonetheless. And they believe in this concept of the proletariat rising up and taking control. The poor people have never ruled anybody. Secondly,
and whose fault is that? Is that the public education system and the parents or what, Bruce?
Well, as far as the rich ruling over the poor, that's not the fault of anybody. That's just the way it is in the world.
Well, weren't we dumped down?
Whether the public understands it or not can be blamed on a host of factors.
Well, wasn't
media?
I mean, wouldn't that have been
educational system?
Okay.
The whole religious system that we now have. Christianity has morphed into something else. We have a modern theology out there that doesn't accurately resemble the theology of a few hundred years ago, and certainly doesn't resemble the theology of Scripture.
Isn't that kind of like this trying to sell us whatever mythology we're willing to accept or and abide by that fits their criteria to morph us into their agenda?
Yeah, it's easy to do. The whole system of oppression that we're under, and a lot of people would even deny that it's a system of oppression, but it just depends on how much they understand about what kind of a system they're in. But the whole system operates on a voluntary basis. It's a contractual system of servitude, which is one of the reasons it's so difficult to unravel and to understand and point a finger in the correct direction. As people have pointed out in the past, that when you point your finger at someone else, there are three fingers pointing back at you. And that we should take as a lesson, because we are the primary problem. We are the cause of our own enslavement. And being ignorant of that enslavement and the method by which we were enslaved certainly makes it much, much easier.
Well, it's not like our contractual agreements, though, are on the up and up. Often they're through deception. So, I mean, to take the whole blame ourselves, I find that, you know, not really fair in its, you know, own right.
Well, I would agree with you, Melody, except that over the years I have talked with so many people and made an attempt at least to explain how we became enslaved. And I can't tell you how many people have looked me in the face and coldly told me they don't care. The system gets them what they want. And I find that even when people are awakened, most people don't want to make any changes in the way they live. And that's one of the most disheartening aspects of probably the last 30 years of my life. It's bad enough that I've given up so much of my time trying to open the eyes of people. But the most disheartening part is when people say they don't care. They like the system, and they don't understand it. And they almost arrogantly refuse to do anything about it. And that's why the... Go ahead.
The popular frame seems to be, what do you want me to do about it? And then they move on.
Yeah, and usually the question is asked in that flippant sort of way. And you can tell oftentimes by the way the question is asked whether the person sincerely wants to do anything about it at all.
And, they're willfully
oftentimes
blind.
They don't.
They choose to remain willfully blinded.
Yeah. Well, and the scriptures pretty much say that. You know, the prophets prophesy falsely. The priests bear rule by their means. And my people love to have it so, says Jeremiah in chapter 5, toward the end of the chapter, around verse 30, 31, thereabouts. My people love to have it so. It's very difficult to open up the eyes of a person who wants to remain blind.
Okay, Bruce, I see you quoting a lot of Bible verse. What is your background in that arena and why you use that one so often?
Well, years ago, I had been doing some reading about current events. I had read books by all people, like Des Griffin, for example. He had written some interesting books, Descent into Slavery, Fourth Reich of the Rich. And he had referenced the scriptures. And I found that the scriptures bear witness to the truth of what's going on. America's plight is the consequence of our violation of basic fundamental commandments of God. And of course, the church world doesn't even like to hear the word commandments or statutes or judgments. So you have to back off from those words and use words like biblical principles. And they'll listen a little bit more intently when you use those words. But they're afraid that you're going to try to take them back into sacrificial law and all of that sort of thing. But I came to the conclusion that America got its foundation and its beginning primarily because of the people who came to this continent and who hammered out the original documents, like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and so forth. And I know it's very popular at this point in time to attack those people because of the Masonic influence and so forth that they had. But I'm still inclined to believe that in the 1700s, the average American was far more respectful of the Bible than the average American is today. And the principles of Scripture are woven in parts of our Constitution. Our monetary system was, for the most part, a biblically sound monetary system. There was a slight flaw in the original Coinage Act of 1792, but one of the most important features of keeping government a servant of the people, which I believe is a Christian principle, which Christ taught his own disciples, that you had to have a means by which to hold government in that position of subservience. And the way you do that is you pay them in hard money. And as long as government was dependent upon the public to pay them in the hard money, gold and silver, government had to do the public's bidding. But when we destroyed the monetary system and converted to a credit system where government can just simply print numbers on rags in cooperation with the Federal Reserve System, a private banking system, they no longer depend upon the public for their funding. All they want from the public is, one, the obedience, and number two, their production. And they get that with licenses to steal. They call them Federal Reserve notes today. Most people erroneously call it money.
So they're no different than a corporation, then, in their expectations.
Well, I suppose.
And since they are, most of them are corporations, then you find, you know, that they're kind of like one and the same. And so, you know, what we're dealing with here is that marriage of the two, and many of us think we're fighting for one when we're actually dealing with the other, but they seem to kind of jump back and forth between one and the other. Just a thought.
Yeah. I almost don't care if government is a corporation, if we have a king, if we have a division of powers like we have currently, or supposed to have. We don't actually have it anymore, you know, the separation of powers doctrine. What we need is a system of law that is consistent with a righteous standard, and I would say that the scriptures provide that righteous standard. When the Bible, for example, says that thou shalt not steal, most people would nod their head approvingly and say, yeah, that's a good law. Yeah. The fact is we've got a system that steals, and we've got a population that loves to steal. The whole system is predicated on theft, which has been legalized. I call it legal plunder, which is kind of a takeoff on the phrase legal tender. We don't have a system which uses anything as money, and there's probably someone in your audience who would immediately disagree with that, and so I will offer anyone in your audience 100 pounds of free money. All they have to do is to identify the substance of the money that we currently measure in dollars that government collects, spends, or wastes, or that any bank pretends to lend. Identify the substance of the money. That way we ought to be able to know if we're dealing with a gas, liquid, or a solid, something that you can see, smell, hear, taste, and or touch. It responds to one or more of the five human senses. Okay? We ought to be able to identify it in terms of its specific gravity, its atomic number, the color. Are we dealing with a metal? Are we dealing with something that's made out of wood? What kind of a substance are we dealing with that we measure in dollars?
Not a damn thing.
That using his money. What was that?
Not a damn thing.
Not a thing? No. Now, most people will jump on that, and those who do, and very few people really do try to answer the question. I'm amazed. As many times as I have asked that question of individuals, very few people even attempt to provide an answer. And those who do generally will say something like paper. They think that we use paper as money. In fact, people use the expression paper money. But paper has never, ever been used as money anywhere in the world, to the best of my knowledge, ever. And the reason is because paper is too heavy. How much paper would it take to purchase a new Cadillac Escalade, for example? And toilet paper is a good, useful kind of paper. I think most people have a use for that from time to time. So let's just take something like a useful commodity like toilet paper. How much toilet paper would it take to purchase a new Cadillac SUV?
Maybe three shiploads.
You need boxcar loads of it, okay? The numbers that appear on a $100 bill, for example, have no connection whatsoever to a quantity of paper. If they did, a $100 bill would have to be 100 times more paper than a $1 bill. Now, when we go back to the old days of gold and silver coinage, and you look at the gold coinage, let's say, I'll just single those out for simplicity's sake, the United States Treasury used to stamp out gold coins in one, two and a half, I think even $3 denomination for a while, five, $10, and $20 denominations. A $20 gold coin was exactly, precisely 20 times heavier and 20 times more gold than a $1 gold coin. And the accuracy of the coinage was held to within three places to the right of the decimal point. Okay? A $5 gold coin weighed one quarter as much as a 20. It weighed half as much as a 10. It weighed five times as much as a 1. You could tell if you were a blind man. You could tell when a person handed you a $5 gold coin instead of a 1 because it was a larger diameter and it was five times heavier than the 1. Now, when you hand somebody a $1 bill, a $5 bill, a 20 or a 50 or a 100, if you were a blind man, you couldn't tell the difference between one and the other. But if you were using paper as money, the $100 bill would have to be 100 times heavier. It would have to be 100 times more paper than the $1 bill. We do not use paper as money. The Federal Reserve is very clear on that, that what we use is debt. In fact, they say that banks create money by monetizing debt. And debt, by definition, Black's Law Dictionary will cite State versus Doucet in virtually all of their editions, from at least the fourth edition all the way up to the sixth or seventh. debt is a sum of money due or owing. In other words, all of your people in your audience, Melody, all the money that they work for, all the money that they save, all the money that they spend or even waste is the money that they never received, because the banking system, which is the source of all of that stuff, every single so-called dollar is put into circulation by a bank, either the Federal Reserve Bank or a commercial bank. Every dollar is created out of absolutely nothing. There is absolutely nothing that is put into circulation, used as money by the banking system. They still owe it to us. They're the ones who are actually in debt, not us.
Makes total sense to me.
Well, you're too knowledgeable.
Oh no, I'm. Listen, I'm just an American guy. You know, I don't know a whole lot of anything. All I know is that I woke up about 6 years ago, and the more that unfolds before me, the angrier I get if I think about it too much. And I've, in fact, today I consider that I'm surrounded by criminals. I'm literally surrounded by people who are racketeers and criminals. What say you, Bruce?
Oh, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But the type of criminal activity is fraud and deception, which is what makes it so difficult for the general public to grasp what's going on. My despair is when you lay it out in spades that so many people just roll their eyes and say, it doesn't make any difference, I don't care, the system works. And they don't understand that the fact is they will never own their own home. Most everybody is going to wind up in government housing if they're lucky. No one has the liberty that we had as a people back in the 1700s. And I think back in the 1700s, people were concerned about whether or not they had the liberty, the freedom, if you will, to work by the sweat of their face and to receive the rewards or the fruits of their labor, just as it says in Scripture, that the farmer ought to plow in hope. And the farmer in America, the worker in America, does not plow in hope. What he earns is absolutely nothing. It's units of measure that measure nothing. They're just raw numbers called dollars. And they become worthless over time through a phenomena that most people at least know enough to call inflation, whether they understand the phenomena or not. And inflation is a tax. It's the most effective tax that has ever been devised. It is a system of confiscation. And John Maynard Keynes, the economist from several decades ago, in fact, he was an economist who presided over the Versailles Treaty back around 1919 or thereabouts, had talked about this phenomenon of inflation. In fact, I have in front of me here the 1980 annual report for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. And it was dedicated to John Maynard Keynes. The title of this report, it's an 8.5 by 11, kind of a magazine format. It's about 26 pages. Got a picture of John Maynard Keynes on the cover, and it says, Keynes on Inflation. And I've quoted this many, many times in the various speaking engagements that I've had around the country. I'll go to just page 6 here, and I'll quote this just briefly. Quote, Lenin, now this is from Keynes' book, Economic Consequences of the Peace, which he wrote in 1919. And he said, Lenin, now that would be Vladimir Ulyanov, actually, Nikolai Lenin was the alias that he used. He was communist revolutionary or Bolshevik revolutionary. Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. By this method, they not only confiscate, but they confiscate arbitrarily. And while the process impoverishes many, it actually enriches some. And I'll just stop there. I mean, it goes on and it even gets a little bit better. Governments confiscate from their own people. That's what our government does. The word confiscate means to seize legally. And the word legal means form of law, as opposed to the word lawful, which means substance of law. And substance governs over form. But in America, we've got nothing but form out here, color of law, if you will. Everything is done legally, but there's very little that's now being done lawfully. Our economic system certainly isn't lawful. If you go back to the Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, that was the original Mint Act that established the first mint in Philadelphia, which was where the Capitol used to be before it got moved to Malfunction Junction there and on the Potomac River.
The swamp.
The swamp. The political swamp. Section 11 of that Coinage Act says that all the money, the gold and silver, which shall be issued from said mint, or rather the gold and silver that was issued from said mint, I should say, shall be as money. It said that gold and silver shall be as money. Section 16 of that act said that that it would be a lawful tender in all payments whatsoever. Not a legal tender, a lawful tender. Because substantively, you can deliver gold and silver. Legal tender is only an offer to pay the money. And the offer to pay the money used to be printed or stamped on the notes. You know, it would used to say, you know, the United States of America will pay to the bearer on demand $10. Then you go to the left of the portrait and they would tell you what you got paid $10 of. It would say that this note is legal tender for all this public and private and is redeemable in lawful money. Or it might have even said gold. Or it might have said silver, depending on whether it was a gold certificate, a silver certificate, or if it was a Federal Reserve note or a United States note. But one way or the other, it told you that it was going to pay you the money, which was your prima facie evidence, as you know, that it wasn't the money. It was only an offer of the money. And today, the average American thinks that the offer to pay the money is the money, and the offer to pay it has been removed. In fact, it was removed from notes that began to be issued only a few days after JFK was assassinated back in 1963. It took the promise off, and almost nobody noticed.
Let me interject something here, Bruce.
Sure.
You know, you're obviously a hard money advocate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I noticed that many people described as being of the political right today, libertarians included, are hard money advocates. But I wonder if you have any knowledge vis-a-vis the so-called American system of political economy and what occurred with William Jennings Bryan and his gold speech or whatever the heck it was.
He was a silver advocate, I believe.
That's correct. But I wonder if you're familiar with this thing called the American system of political economy, which was described by Friedrich List, the German who had traveled in America and basically did not live out his life in a normal manner. There's quite a bit of confusion with the American public today, and I know you would agree with that, but there's this thing called the American system of political economy, and this is a thing that is touted by those who think of people like Alexander Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, as well as FDR as heroes. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I'm not familiar with the phrase American system of political economy. That one seems to have passed by me. If someone that can define it, I would be able to render some sort of an observation concerning it. If it embraces the likes of FDR, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, of course, was the first president under the Constitution to have violated the Constitution by the issuance of United States notes, making them a legal tender. That was violative of the Constitution. In fact, what most people don't realize, since I've kind of hit upon that, is that the people in debate in Congress, in the House, and in the Senate, those people who voted for those Lincoln greenbacks or United States notes, all the people who voted for them possibly with one or two exceptions, were against them. Now, all the people who voted against them were against them. But it was a unique piece of legislation in that, and I've read some excerpts from the debates. I mean, they're published in 20 Years of Congress by James G. Blaine, published in 1884. He was Speaker of the House from 1861 to 1881. There are others, A. Barton Hepburn, for example, who was ex-comptroller of the currency, superintendent of banking for the state of New York, and he was head of the Chase National Bank at one time. He had written a book called The Perennial Contest for Sound Money. I think he wrote it in 1903 or 1905, and I have that book. And he quotes from the debates. And it's amazing that the people who voted for the Lincoln Greenbacks knew they were violating the Constitution when they voted for those things. And the reason they voted for them is the same reason we got the Patriot Act after 9/11. It's because there was an emergency. And when an emergency raises its ugly head, people will do strange things when it comes to abiding by or violating their oath of office.
Yeah, I think it was his Secretary of War or Secretary of Treasury that brought that idea forward, that caused Lincoln to press for that legislation because they want to prosecute the war with worthless script.
Yeah, if you can't pay for a war as you go, if you can't pay for it in money, then you resort to credit. That's what we do on a personal basis. And America went to credit. And the sad part of using a credit system, particularly when you've got two sides of a conflict using credit, is you can prolong the agony of a war. And you can take far more lives and cause far more destruction. Now, you, at the end of the war, you have to ante up. You've got to pay your bill, and this time you have to pay your bill in hard stuff plus interest. So it's cheaper to fight the war up front and pay for it on a pay-as-you-go basis, you know. And if people did that, there would be fewer wars because wars are pecuniarily expensive. But when you fight a war on credit, you delay the expense, and people are a little bit more willing to shed more blood. And like I say, they'll shed it for a long time when they fight the war on credit.
But they play into the hands of those that are utilizing credit for that very purpose, right?
Try that again.
I mean, they're playing into the hands of those who issue the credit.
Yeah.
Right.
We have fallen for this. You know, the average person has been taught to use a credit system. We were taught as youngsters to establish good credit. Doesn't that sound nice? You have a good credit rating, the banker says as he smiles to you. What he's saying is that you're going to now be his perpetual debtor. Now, to be a perpetual debtor doesn't sound very good. But to have a good line of credit and to be creditworthy, that sounds so much better. And yet debt and credit are correlatives. Okay? If you go in debt, somebody has extended you credit. If somebody has extended you credit, you're in debt, you're a debtor. But it just doesn't sound good to be a debtor. So that's just one of the ways that we were taught how to play this game. In fact, when I was a kid, I remember, I think it was in sixth grade, we used to have a little plastic sign. It looked about the size of a license plate on an automobile, and it said Tuesday is bank day. And we used to bring in our silver coins, because this was back in the 1950s when I was in sixth grade. And we'd bring in our silver coins, and we'd deposit them to the Brunswick Savings and Loan. Now, if we had kept playing that game come 1965, all of our silver would have been confiscated. And if we had closed out our account in 1965, we would not have gotten a single silver coin back, most likely. We would have gotten back nothing but copper nickel junk, the cheap stuff of today.
Okay. Do you think this real turning point was at least partially and even largely due to the assassination of JFK? Because I sense that the nation changed after that date. in history?
I think it probably was somewhat of a turning point. I look back on the early 1960s as being kind of a golden age. America was still reaping the rewards of a much more fiscally sound and morally sound foundation. It's kind of like the highest temperature of the day does not occur when the sun is directly overhead, which might be noon. The highest temperature is usually about 2 hours later. And I think so it is with America. America had already begun destroying its underpinnings, its constitutional and its biblical underpinnings, long before Kennedy was assassinated. But there was the momentum of the country that had caused us to still continue reaping rewards long after we had actually started changing direction. In fact, it was pointed out, I remember reading about supertankers, you know, those great big things that ply the Atlantic. They're about 1,000 feet long, 100, 110 feet wide. And I remember reading that it takes something like, I think, 30 minutes to bring one of those things to a stop from cruising speed. And you have to be in full reverse, 100% power or thereabouts, I guess, in order to be able to accomplish this. And you'll go about 20 miles, I think, before you bring it to a stop. And you're directionally uncontrollable all during that time. And America is kind of like a giant supertanker. America is still coasting. Its monetary system, like I said, died almost 50 years ago. No money. I mean, the country's been operating on 100% credit, even what people call cash, our credit instruments. And then we abandoned our promise to pay on those instruments. In fact, that's what I'm talking about, actually. We abandoned our promise to pay on all of those gold certificates, silver certificates, U.S. notes, Federal Reserve notes, and so forth. In fact, gold notes, those were abandoned in 1933-34.
So we've come to be dominated by a handful of private individuals, most of whom are not even Americans.
Yeah. I firmly believe that Solomon knew exactly what he was talking about, that the rich ruleth over the poor and the borrower is a servant to the lender. When you get down to naming names, the names that generally pop into people's minds, those who know something about banking, one of the first names they'll think of here in the States is David Rockefeller. You know? And, of course, his grandfather, you know, John D. Rockefeller, and his father, who is John D. Rockefeller II, I guess, who created the Council on Foreign Relations. David Rockefeller was the founder of the Trilateral Commission, I think, was established in 1971, a rich man's club. It's all the rich people who get together and basically decide what's what, and the public is told to go along. And then we're made to feel as though we can control everything by voting, you know. They give us the two choices, the primary choices, to vote for, Tweedledee or Tweedledum, and the public does what they're told, and they'll vote for one or the other. But both of them have already been pre-approved by the organizations like the CFR and the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and AIPAC, you know, the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee. Don't want to forget them. They're an extremely powerful lobby, probably one of the most powerful lobbies in the country.
Well, yeah, one of the most shameful moments that I can remember in my lifetime in American citizen in American history that actually made me feel ashamed to think of myself as an American was that recent AIPAC conference, or that where they had like 350 Congress people cheering on AIPAC. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not one who follows mainstream news very much these days. I kind of got discouraged with the certain people who control media.
As far as I'm concerned, when I think of dual citizen Israeli Americans, or when I think of the State of Israel, I think of really people who are cheerleaders for the City of London and their partners in crime on Wall Street. These people are, in essence, you know, they're following the King of the Jews as far as they're concerned. They consider that's who rules America, and they're right.
Yeah, yeah. Because that takes us into another bailiwick as to who is Israel, or what is a Jew, and what's the word Gentile.
I mean, well, I specifically use the word State of Israel.
Yeah. There are three primary realms in which I deal in my latest book, Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder, and that is the realm of religion, politics, and economics. Of course, my parents taught me to never talk about politics or religion, either one, when you're dealing with your neighbor. Those were just taboo subjects. You always keep your mouth shut about those. But it is the religion of a people that establishes their political system, and the political system will oversee and administer their economic system. If you change the religion of a people, you will change the political system. The political system will then administer a new and different economic system. And
so you really have to speak of this. I mean, it really should be a discussed topic then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and a lot of people, probably even people in your audience, for all I know, who might honestly believe that they don't have a religion at all, you know, that they're not practitioners of Judaism or Islam or Christianity, and therefore they have no religion. But the religion of no religion is actually a religion. It's called secular humanism in most circles. It's where we venerate the mind of God, the mind of man, and we've made man our God. And a lot of people consider themselves to be their own God. Whoever makes law is God. And I remember asking a jury one time down in Texas, who or what is the ultimate authority in your life above or beyond which there is no appeal? Some Christians will say God and His Word. Other people will say the Supreme Court. Some people might say Congress, or it might be the United Nations. I don't know. But there is an authority out there which invariably turns out to be man-made, which in most people's minds is, in effect, God, because that is the ultimate authority in their life. That's the authority that can make law and say what is right and what is wrong. And that's where Christians and Muslims and so forth will get kind of stiffened up, and they'll say, no, God is the one who decides what's right and what's wrong. And so I break things down into very simple terms. Either God makes the rules, that's a theocracy, theos, the Greek word theos, God, kratein, to make the rules, or democracy, demos, means man, plus kratein in the Greek, which means to make rule. Those are the two fundamental divisions of the political realm. Either God makes the rules, and we just carry them out, or man makes the rules. And obviously in America, man is making the rules. Elite man, of course, you know, the people at the top, not us. I mean, we're just the cannon fodder down below here.
Yeah, we certainly don't have a defined rule of law by which we operate. We basically... the American people have been deceived by this thing called democracy in the first place.
Yeah.
If I might, let me share with y'all a quick bit from Alexander Fraser Tyler in 1887. He was a Scottish history professor at the University of Edinburgh, and he had this to say about the fall of the Athenian Republic some 2,000 years prior. A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. A democracy will continue to exist up until the time that voters discover that they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the results that every democracy will finally collapse over loose fiscal policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's great civilizations from the beginning of history has been about 200 years. During those 200 years, these nations always progress through the following sequence: from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependence, from dependence back into bondage. And this reads as an obituary. The American Republic, born 1776, died 2012. Care to respond?
Oh, I think I could have said it better. I've actually read that. I didn't remember who had penned those words.
Yeah, the year wouldn't have been 2012 when I read it, so it was prior to that. So,
America entered bondage, quite a while ago. The average American is begging for government to solve all of their problems. We don't want to have the personal responsibility. It's the same in our personal health. The average American wants to eat what he wants to eat, as much of it as he wants to eat, even though most of what's now in the grocery store isn't fit for human consumption. I mean, we've got genetically modified seed. We've got chemicals galore. We've got poisons in our water supply. I mean, people believe that you can put chlorine into water and make it fit to drink. Then you can put fluoride in the water, and good Lord, we are suffering. You just look at the people who go in and out of a typical Walmart store, and you look what kind of condition we are in as a people. It's pathetic. But then we want to have the American Medical Association provide a quick fix. And the AMA isn't the least bit interested, in general, in cause. My wife's a nurse, a former nurse. You know, I used to work at the Cleveland Clinic for 17 years. And I used to aggravate her when I first met her years ago. What does the medical profession say the causes of this disease or this one or that one? She says they'll tell you they don't know. Yeah, but they're willing to treat the disease. Isn't that odd? We treat what we don't know the cause. If you knew the cause, you could just simply back out. You know, if you knew the cause of something, you would reverse your direction, and you would cure. But we're not interested in curing. We treat.
I wonder if your wife would consider that she was working within a criminal enterprise those years.
I think she's probably come pretty close to concluding that by now. All of us, you and I, Melody, my wife, people like us, we've begun to feed on alternative information. The information that has been presented to us in the past has been stilted. It's been biased. A lot of people today are beginning to suspect the bias. And probably, I guess, as they watch the Ron Paul proceedings, and see how mainstream media has blackballed him, marginalized him, whether you support Ron Paul or you don't, it is immaterial. The fact is that they have done everything under the sun to keep that man from getting a hearing. And if nothing else out of this election and the last one, the public should by now realize that it's time to turn off mainstream media. Just walk away from it. I turned off mainstream media back in 1976. That's why I don't know what's going on.
Well, good for you. As far as I'm concerned, it was after my parents were both deceased, Bruce, that I realized that they were both socialist. They had actually been brainwashed to be socialist. Right. And they would never have admitted as much. My parents were probably like yours. Who they voted for was something sacred. They respected neighbors' private property, and fences were a good thing. And they were good people. They had good credit. My goodness, my father, after all of us kids left home, even volunteered to be a neighborhood watchman. Remember Weed and Seed and McGruff the Crime Dog?
Yeah.
He would arm himself with his trusty .22 and actually, in the middle of the night, drive the neighborhood as really a volunteer to protect the property values of the neighborhood and keep the crime out. And of course, he was a career U.S. military. My mother was civil service. They looked to the government as God.
Yeah.
Uncle Sam was, you sure don't want to you know, do anything against Uncle Sam. They were what most people would regard as good Americans, but they had been brainwashed to be socialists. It's just so tragic, and it's I saw it happen that, you know how it is, when you get in trouble in this life, who do you call upon to get you out of trouble? Well, it's either a doctor or a lawyer in most cases, perhaps a CPA. But all of these people are engaged in criminal racketeering today. Every one of them. And they were induced, you know, doctors and nurses, they go into the profession thinking they're going to do good in this world. But surely, 10 years into their careers, they must realize that there's so much corruption and criminality. I think that, in truth, they have been induced into lives of organized crime, and they can't escape it.
Well, in a sense, don't you see that they have, in their training, they went through a rigorous mind control program?
Sure. In fact, the most brainwashed people today are those people that call themselves experts, whether domestic and foreign policy, even these phony economists I hear all the time, Bruce, they just really make me sick to listen to them.
Well, I guess I'll take this kind of back into the realm of the economic again, if I may. One of the newspaper articles that was sent to me back in 1982 came from the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and an acquaintance of mine out in St. Louis sent it to me. And it was an article written by Louis Rukeyser. I mean, there are probably people in the audience who remember that name. He was a Wall Street Week television host and on public access TV, I guess. And the article was entitled, "Just What Is Money? Does Anyone Know?" Louis Rukeyser, you know, Dateline New York. This was written back on the 1st of June, 1982, and I'm reading it from the St. Louis Globe Democrat. And it was in the business section, Section C. The article started out this way. "Some of the nation's leading experts on money have begun very quietly to make what many would regard as an astonishing admission. They don't know what they're talking about." In this case, as it happens, they mean it literally. They don't know what money, quote-unquote money, is in 1982.
So they admit they're lemmings.
Yeah. And he says, until they do, the much publicized attempts to get the United States money supply under control are as unlikely to be unsuccessful or to be successful as brain surgery performed by a kindergartner. And he gives an example. He says, take George W. McKinney, Jr., a highly respected economist who is retiring next month from New York's Irving Trust Company. Now, this man would have retired in July of 1982. And just a month before he retires, he's asked a question at a seminar, apparently, where Louis Rukeyser was in attendance. He says to McKinney, this is Rukeyser now asking the question, "Is it then," I inquired innocently, "that we just don't know what money is these days?" Here's the answer. Quote, "Never did know," confessed McKinney. And then, while listeners to our conversation chuckled nervously, made clear he wasn't kidding. End quote. Now look, this is an expert. Not an expert right out of college. This is an expert who worked for New York's Irving Trust Company, retired in July of 1982, and admitted 1 month before retirement that he didn't know what money was, and he never knew what money was. And yet all of us, the three of us certainly, probably by the time we were 5 or 6 years old, had heard the word money. Mom would give us a piece of silver or something and say, "Would you go down to the store and get me a loaf of bread? Okay, here's some money," quote unquote. Well, back in those days, there probably was some money in circulation. There was when I was a kid. At least something that you could use as money, and silver could be used as money. This is a word that is in our vocabulary. It is so thoroughly entrenched in our vocabulary, and experts can't define the word.
Well, isn't it kind of they're not dealing in money, so they don't need money in reference to them, even though they use that term. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you keep hearing everybody speak of democracy, even though that's not even our form of government.
Well,
it is today, unfortunately.
I could agree with that, Melody, but I would also want to augment what you've said
okay.
by pointing out that when you go to a law dictionary and you look up the word money, I'm going to open up, I've got here a 6th edition Black's Law Dictionary, and I will open it up to the word money. And they still quote from a case called Lane versus Rayleigh. Listen to how Black's Law Dictionary defines the word money. Quote, in usual and ordinary acceptation, it means coins and paper currency used as circulating medium of exchange and does not embrace notes, bonds, or evidence of debt. Now, I realize that you're not looking at the definition. I have the advantage of being able to see it. You only heard it, so it kind of came and went. What they're saying is that money is coins or it's paper currency. The paper currency, as you will recall, prior to 1963, bore a promise to pay the money. Therefore, a promise to pay the money is an evidence of debt. Yet they say here in Lane versus Rayleigh, which is the controlling case apparently on this definition of money, that money includes coin and promises to pay the coin. Well, a promise to pay money cannot be money. They are not synonyms. And furthermore, since 1963, the promise to pay the money was removed, and the public is not able to get the money for any note, even if it's a gold certificate or a silver certificate. Those instruments which bore the promise, they were the evidence of debt. They were notes. A note, by definition, is an absolute and unconditional promise by the maker or the drawee to pay a sum certain of money at a specified time or on demand, and it was to be paid to someone. So you had to identify who was paying, what was being paid, who was being paid, and when they were going to be paid. You can't find that on a Federal Reserve note today, and yet Federal Reserve notes still call themselves notes.
Okay, Bruce.
Federal Reserve notes don't call themselves money. See, what we've done is we have changed the definition of terms to include things that were never money.
Okay, now take.
And we've got a definition that is so broad that it is now an absurdity.
Okay, now if you take that to the point of where we're at in this point in time and you have a banking system that is trying to hold, take our assets and promise them out and enslave us with something that's imaginary, where do you go with that? Because what they're trying to enslave us with is something that never existed.
Yeah, it's a mind control game. When a person goes to the bank to take a loan, most people believe that they honestly got a loan. But banks don't lend anything. In a case called United States versus Neifert White, the court very eloquently defined what a loan was. And they said that in order to constitute a loan, there must be a contract whereby in substance one party transfers to another a sum of money. I will give anybody in your audience 100 pounds of free money if they can identify the substance that any bank lends to anybody, that loan being measured in dollars, because dollars are not tangible things. Dollars are a unit of measure in the decimal system, just like ounce is a unit of measure in the avoirdupois system. Or in the Troy system. Okay, we're just dealing in units of measure that don't measure anything. So, we've got a system that lends absolutely nothing. But it is such an officious-looking charade that the public buys into it. There isn't a loan of anything. If there is no money, you can't lend any of it. A Hertz Navis would love to be able to rent automobiles that they don't have. But they can't. when the parking lot is empty, they're out of the rental business until somebody brings back a car, or they go out and purchase a new one to put it into the lot. Banks are not limited by that god-awful system of tangible assets, because banks deal in the intangible world of credit. The word credit comes from the Latin word credere, or credo, actually, but credit, or credere, which means to believe. What does belief look like? Can you see, smell, or hear, or taste, or touch belief? No. What's the atomic number of a belief? There isn't anything. And they transfer it from one person to another on a piece of paper, and admittedly, you can see the piece of paper, but the paper is not what you're using as money. The paper merely transfers a quantity of this imaginary money. And banks create this stuff out of absolutely nothing and take title to what people are working for by the sweat of their brow, and then demand that the people not only pay back the principal, but pay back interest on top of that.
Right.
Which then creates a mathematical impossibility, because you cannot return to a sole source, which is the banking system, more than you borrowed from it. If a bank loaned you 10 eggs and told you you had to pay back 11, where does the 11th egg come from if the banks own all the chickens? Somebody has to borrow the 11th egg into circulation at interest in order for the first person who owed 10, or actually owes 11, but borrowed them, to be able to earn, possibly, that 11th egg.
So it's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And when we start realizing that what the charade is, or the illusion that's taken place, that they're trying to take our tangible assets for something that they've made up, and not only doing that through enslavement, I mean, that in its own right, you know, people really need to wake up to. And, I mean, it's worked for them.
you'd think that we would wake up, but one of the reasons we can't wake up is because we're dealing in a world where textbooks have omitted so much of our valuable history. I mean, the quotation that Lark gave us, for example, from that history professor or whatever from Scotland. You're not going to read that in a modern textbook. In fact, I quote a number of times from The History of Banking in All the Leading Nations. It was published in four volumes back in 1896. Now, I have reprints, which were done in 1971. Each one of these volumes is 500 pages long, give or take a couple pages. Okay, and in one of those, volume 2, at page 210, here's what we could have learned if we had read this book back in 1896. Quote, "For what is the commodity which a banker deals in and makes a profit by? He opens his business and has an array of clerks with their desks, ledgers, etc. He then gives notice that he is ready to buy gold from anyone who has it to sell. And what is the commodity with which he buys the gold? What does he give in exchange for it? His own credit." Period. You can't buy anything with credit. Credit is intangible. In fact, the courts in the United States have said over and over and over again that a bank is without power to lend its credit. It's against the law. You can't do it. I can't do it. Everybody in the world goes to jail if they do what banks do.
So is that why they are so intent on us having to put up some kind of a asset so that they have something to loan from?
Oh, they want collateral.
Right, collateral.
Yeah. Okay. But it sustains the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a friend of mine years ago was a trucker for Yellow Freightways out in Iowa. And he told me one day that he had a shipment in the big box back there behind his tractor, and it was silver. And I don't know, I don't know if they were 100-ounce bars or if they were larger bars than that, but I think they were at least 100-ounce bars. That trailer was basically grossed out. I don't know how many, you probably wouldn't have gone too many feet high off the floor. But it was loaded with silver. You know, he didn't even have an assistant driver.
Hmm.
No security. Hauling silver. Now, when you go downtown, the odds are, in the course of a week, if you go downtown enough times, you're going to see an armored car. And the armored car may stop at a bank. Now, the armored car has bulletproof glass, bulletproof tires. It has gun ports out the sides. It has at least two armed guards. And what are they carrying in that armed car? Dishonored Federal Reserve notes and copper nickel tokens. All the stuff that is in there is intrinsically worthless. They don't carry gold. They don't carry silver. But all of this conveys the illusion that this stuff is valuable. And that's the world in which we live.
Okay, now, Bruce, to take it a step further, in one of your presentations on your radio program, you got into what is taking place with our youth, and I find this to be very pertinent in my situation right now. These young children are being convinced not only to go in debt for these educations, but what used to be considered a time frame for getting an education, they've now added several years on top of that so that they can add to that debt limit. And so would you like to elaborate a little bit on what they're doing to our kids and under that illusion?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Melody, because back in the 80s, I was approached by a minister out in Colorado, and I think that's where you are,
mm-hmm.
James Lambert. And he asked if I would put together a brochure or a pamphlet or whatever on the subject of credit and debt and aim that pamphlet at the young people. And it was called The Pernicious Treadmill of Credit. I just recently, I think you're probably referring to one of the broadcasts where I think I pulled a Time magazine that somebody had sent me from October 31, 2011, and the article was entitled IOU, and they featured, I've got the magazine here, let's see if I can find the page 40 and 41, and they featured five young people. There was a girl who owed $30,000 on her BA in English that she got at Fordham University back in 2011. And the debt goes up. There's a girl who owed $50,000 on her college loan. There was another student who owed $67,000. Another one owed $120,000. Another one owed $112,000. I mean, these kids are going into phenomenal debt so that they can go to college. And as one of these girls had pointed out, that she grew up with this narrative, she said, I grew up with this narrative that to get a good job, I need to go to school. My dad used to tell me that. He used to tell me, Bruce, get a good education. They can never take that away from you. And I would respond, Dad, the kind of education they're giving me, they don't want to take away from me.
That was a good line.
I'm surprised that I was as perspicacious back then at only about 17 years. I graduated 17. But they sent me to a private school to make sure that I got my secular humanism communist doctrine on a better student to faculty ratio. Okay. I didn't see things all that clearly back then, but I just knew that there was something wrong. But you know, there was one girl in this article, Melody, who I think her name was Lindsay. She didn't want to give her last name, and I can understand why. She had studied documentary filmmaking at New York University, and she took a student loan. And her payments are currently $1,269 a month.
Mm.
And this is going to be something like, I think it's a 26, yes, it's 26 years it's going to take her at that rate. And she's going to pay back off this loan. The loan was $169,934. But she's got to pay back $350,000. Because there's an interest charge, you see. It's going to take 26 years. And as she points out, she says, I don't know what's going to happen. She says, if I want to get married or have children, she says, I am bringing into a potential marriage, if I get married, I'm bringing a new house on my shoulder that we can't live in.
And the really sad part about that is they're hitting these kids at an age that they have, I mean, it's taken many of us years to figure out how we were being scammed into this process and, right. And the particulars of it, and yet they're hitting them right out of high school, and they're taking on a debt that, you know, before they even be able to have any spending money, it's as though they've already been through a divorce.
Yeah, and the beauty of a credit system, and I put beauty in quotation marks, is that since banks don't lend anything, there is no limit as to how far in debt they can put us. You know, Hertz and Avis can only rent you as many cars as they've got on the lot, you know. But the banking system has no problem. The banking system as a whole can put us as far in the hole as they want to put us. And then they've got the government courts, which will enforce the repayment.
Right.
See, what banks do is against the law. And when I say it's against the law, it's against the laws of God, because that's where law ultimately comes from. When the Bible says, thou shalt not steal, it doesn't say that government can steal if it's got a good program. It doesn't say that banks can steal if they've got a good program going. Nobody can steal. Okay? It also commands just weights and measures. Okay? Now, in order to have just weights and measures, that would presuppose that there is something, some tangible thing, to be weighed or to be measured. And we used to use something as money. And those things were gold and silver, and then for small acquisitions, we used copper. And you could weigh those things, and we used to weigh them in the decimal system called dollars and cents. And in the decimal system, there's 100 parts, or there are 100 parts to the whole, 100% to the whole, 100 cents to the dollar. Dollar was a unit of weight measurement, and almost nobody today knows that, including coin dealers. Now, you could convert from decimal to troy, or you could convert from decimal to avoirdupois, or you could convert from troy to avoirdupois, and so forth and so on. All you had to do was to plug in the fudge factor. Okay? But when that coin said that it had, if it said $1 on that little gold coin, or if it said $10, they're telling you what the weight of that coin was in the decimal system, not what it was worth, because that was worth different things to different people. To an attorney, it's not worth as much as a person who maybe works manual labor and doesn't have as high a wage. Okay.
You know, one other aspect of that, though, is when you get out there and you're dealing in, say, like coins, then they take it to another level by adding in all these other factors. Oh, well, you know, the demand, there's this point system, there's this system. And before you know it, what you thought you had a weight and measure that should have been standard is totally modified. Right?
Well, when America's coinage first began, it was definable, and you could go to the Coinage Act, which was very short. It was only, you're only talking 3 or 4 pages. There were only 20 sections to the Act. I mean, imagine a piece of legislation that opens, that starts the first mint and establishes what you're going to use as money. It establishes what the unit of measurement is going to be, called dollar, and fractions thereof. And this piece of legislation occupied only 20 sections, 20 paragraphs, very short paragraphs. I mean, nowadays, when you get a piece of legislation like the NAFTA treaty, you're talking 25,000 pages.
Right, right.
Which nobody reads, you know. And they put all kinds of interesting provisos in there and bind everybody down. You know, Congress will pass, they pass the Patriot Act without reading it. It was too long. So we just sign our names and we agree that the American people are going to be bound by this act, even though we don't know what it said, even though we were representing those people.
Well, you know, going back to a little bit to the education costs, some other things that they throw in on this, while you're trying to deal with and understand the debt that they're trying to put you in. They're utilizing high pressure sales. They're not even representing everything to with all the information. They tell you what they think you want to hear. And so these kids get stuck in that, and they can't get out of this obligation that never, again, like you bring it back to a monetary system that is based on illusion.
Yeah.
If I might, Melody, let me relate a story regarding this debt, this onerous debt that you describe, and what it actually does to families and to individuals and these kids. I have a niece who's 27 years old. Approximately 3 or 4 years ago, she obtained her degrees from a Marxist university in California, and her degrees were in geography and Spanish. Now, get this. She went into debt some $40,000, give or take, for a degree in geography. Now, she understood that she could always become a teacher. And yet she was torn by should she be entrepreneurial or should she work the system that she was indoctrinated to. So guess what? She decided that she didn't really have enough life experience or get up and go or gumption to go any entrepreneurial route, even though her uncle here was quite happy to lend her the means of production on very favorable terms, practically free, with hardly any strings attached. But what did she do? She wound up changing bedpans at a nursing home through a program sponsored by AmeriCorps, which is a communitarian, when it was founded, it was called a communist program, quite frankly. But that's what she's doing today. She's changing bedpans.
Well, that
and paying off this debt.
And that's going to be part of the system of those. I don't know if it's going to be. Well, it is when you look at what they do with the medical school students. That not only do they have to, you know, go into debt, deep debt, they've got to, you know, work for nothing and go under a system that's almost tyrannical in its use of their time.
And they're entering a life of organized crime. That's all there is to it, because allopathic medicine is largely built on false science. It was used as a weapon of war by the British and their partners in the Pilgrim Societies, the so-called Anglo-American establishment that was right there with the formation of the Federal Reserve, because they knew that as long as they understood the system, that they could benefit. And they've enslaved the American people. And what they're going to find out is they themselves are going to be enslaved, because even these Fortune 500 companies that are the main drivers of this of all the legislation today, these people are entirely dependent upon their bankers, as any small businessman knows, that utilizes credit to grow his or her company. And this communitarian system is only going to lead towards world communism, as far as I'm concerned. What say you, Bruce?
Yeah. it's all interrelated. I mean, what we're talking about this evening primarily, although we're kind of jumping around to other subjects, which are somewhat related, interrelated, we're talking about the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto, which says, and there are only 10 planks, according to Karl Marx, who wrote this back in 1848, the fifth plank says centralization of credit, not money, centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank, state capital, and an exclusive monopoly. That's the system that we have. That's the system that was finalized in 1913, 2 days before Christmas, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed. But one of the things that crossed my mind just a moment ago was that there are people who probably just don't think that we could go back to using hard money because you have to carry around so much of that heavy metal. In fact, I read these monetary reformers who want to nationalize the Federal Reserve System. They say they want to end the Fed, but they really don't. They want to nationalize it.
What they're leading us to is to accepting the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah, they want strict compliance with the Fifth Flank. In fact, Dennis Kucinich, who's a congressman here from Ohio, he had put a bill forward on behalf of what's called the American Monetary Institute. Well, it's not a monetary institute at all. It's a credit institute.
And his Italian-born wife, by the way, is a hard-boiled communist.
Yeah, it's. I've got a copy of the bill, and in the bill they say that they want to incorporate the Federal Reserve System into the executive branch of the federal government. That's not getting rid of it. That's taking the virus from outside the body and putting it inside the body. Now it's a fait accompli. It's part of the government, finally.
But doesn't it go back to, isn't it Khrushchev or Gorbachev that said we would, you know, the way we would be doing, incorporating what they were living under and gladly doing so?
Yeah. In fact, it was Khrushchev who said that we would supply the rope with which we would hang ourselves. Okay. It's kind of a pity. But back in the old days, if I would like to leave this with your audience. There's somebody out there saying, "Well, what would it really be like with hard money?" You know, because nobody in our generation, or in the previous generation, or in the previous generation, has known what a hard money system is like. In fact, you have to go back to about 1830s or thereabouts to even find yourself living under the Constitutional Republic of the United States, because the Constitution has been emaciated, violated, starting at least with Abraham Lincoln. We don't know even what a free enterprise system is like. We haven't lived under one for so long. But I found an old history book when I was living in Missouri years ago. And this was published also in the year 1884. And I only found one volume. It was volume one. It was called The History of the People of the United States. I still have it. And it was written by John Doc McMaster. And here's what he said on page 19. In fact, I like this history book because he would take one year, like maybe the year 1772, and he would spend maybe 50, 60 to 100 pages telling you what life was like all the way from Massachusetts down to Georgia in that year. And he would draw from newspapers, personal correspondence, diaries, and so on. And then he would take the next year, and he would spend as many pages telling you what life was like in that year. And so here in Volume 1, page 19, he says, "In a paper called Cause of and Cure for Hard Times, published in 1787, an honest old farmer was made to say, quote, 'At this time my farm gave me and my whole family a good living, and left me one year with another 150 silver dollars.'" Now, that's an erroneous statement. There's no such thing as a silver dollar, and we might come back to that if you want to. But he says, "For I never spent more than $10 a year, which was for salt, nails, and the like. Nothing to wear, eat, or drink was purchased, as my farm provided all." And this came from the Connecticut Current, a newspaper, apparently. And it was published in a history book. Now, I asked my readers whether they could save 93% of their dollar earnings today, confident that prices will remain relatively stable, perhaps forever. That's the kind of world it was. Can you imagine? I used to ask audiences years ago on occasion, I try to figure something in the way of an interesting statement to make to start your presentation off, and I would ask my audience, how many people here think that they could live on $150 a year? And of course, I'd get, you know, murmurings and chuckles and so forth. Well, what if it was $150 of silver? And you could see these people trying to calculate what the exchange rate was between silver and Fed notes. And they'd back in those days, it might have been 7 to 1. And they'd go, "Oh, geez, no, I couldn't live on a couple thousand bucks a year. No, no, I just couldn't do it." Well, here's a man who not only lived on 150, he actually lived on 10. He saved 150. He earned 160 in the course of a year, and he saved 150 out of 160.
But
that was a day when people had hard money, and they didn't have an income tax, they didn't have inflation, they didn't have a government that was so out of control that was independent of the public. It was a government that had to be responsive to the people because the people paid that government in hard money. And if the people didn't like that government, they could say, we're not sending you any of our hard money. And Congress would have to go home.
They were living as freemen in a responsible fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least relatively responsible. I wouldn't say that Americans were 100% righteous. I mean, you just don't have a nation as a whole that's 100% righteous, no matter how far back in time you go. But predominantly, we were a more responsible people, a more self-governing people then. And now we've become perpetual whiners at the table where government is God. In fact, that's what Adolf Hitler said, the state is God. And Washington acts that way. And they don't answer to us. They answer to the people who create credit out of nothing. And they will do their bidding. They will not do the public's bidding. The public is now the servant. And government has become not so much the master as the agent for the masters. The masters are in the background. And we're talking very, very powerful people. Those are the people who supposedly own all the gold and the silver. But they didn't get it lawfully. They stole it. They stole it with their dishonored bank credit. It's not lawfully theirs. But until you can wake the American people up to a proper vocabulary where we can define our terms, the American people will never figure this out and will never find a way to solve the problem.
Well, you know, one of the things you're going back to is a system of, you know, you've got to be able to take somebody at their word, and you have to have some honesty there, and the whole thing is built on dishonesty, and then yet they're expecting us to be ethical and honest, and yet the very nature of the beast that they're working with is not even close.
Yeah, but you know, back in the days when a person handed you a piece of silver, if you recognize that piece of silver as having been stamped by a government that was maybe operating within its constitutional bounds, the person who handed it to you might be a dishonest person. But if that was an honest weight coin, you still had honesty. You didn't have to trust in too many people with a hard money system. Nowadays, you got to trust the banker and you got to trust his credit, and he's got to trust you. And of course, the Bible says, you know, cursed is the man who trusts in mankind. We're not worthy of trust. this message, what we're talking about, you know, I've gotten kind of discouraged, you know, with the American public. I know there are exceptions to the rule, and undoubtedly you've got people even in your own audience who are exceptions to the rule. But by and large, the American people are just as Larkin said. They have a socialist mindset. They're takers. They want the world to provide them a living. We've got a township that's it's less than a 30-minute drive from where I'm living. I'm living out in the Puckerbrush here in southeastern Ohio, next to a village that only has a population of 4. It's the smallest village in Ohio. And I'm not even part of that 4. Just imagine that. I'm in the outskirts. But there's a township about 30 minutes drive from me. And one of the public officials told a friend of mine recently that 80% of the people in that township are receiving some form of government assistance.
It's even worse than that, Bruce. I've read some things recently that say that 6 out of every 10 Americans who even have a job, and bearing in mind that 1/3 of the working age population of this country is without work today, 1/3. But 6 out of every 10 Americans today is dependent in whole or in part upon the federal government for their paycheck that sustains them from week to week and month to month. If I might, let me recap about this American system, Bruce, and then I also, Melody, think it might be important for Bruce to provide some contact information vis-a-vis his book, because I have this book, and I must say, it is so concise and so valuable, and I personally regard you, Bruce, as a mentor of mine, because I've learned so much just by reading and rereading this book and realizing how simple it is to comprehend what it is or how it is a free man is supposed to live in this world and not be in bondage or in voluntary or involuntary servitude. And it all relates back to money. And also to, as you point out, religion. You cannot make man your God, because man is a fallible creature, let's face it. And certainly this system of money today is what has enslaved us, I think, probably more than anything. But regarding the American system first, it was a term that was originally invoked by Alexander Hamilton and was popularized in the first half of the 19th century by Henry Clay, who was a Whig representative from, senator from Kentucky, who was called the Great Compromiser in our history books. Now, what he advocated, as did Hamilton, was as Alexander Hamilton advocated in number 11 of the Federalist Papers, 1787, was this thing called an American system, which was characterized by a powerful and activist federal government that would guarantee the sovereignty and prosperity of the United States. Why? Because they would become an issuer of credit. Not money. It went beyond that. And there was a trade war between the larger industrialized cities, mostly in the North, and those of the South. And it was in regards to the tariffs and protectionist policies. Now, I would say today that you cannot have a nation state unless you're protectionist in some way, shape, or form. You have to protect your borders, and you have to protect the people of that territory or that nation state. And yet what we have today is we have people like Lyndon LaRouche who are loudly suggesting that we advocate for things like the American Monetary Institute's bill, that we get the country moving, quote-unquote, again by disavowing this debt, which they call British. LaRouche will say that the enemy of the American people is the British and always has been the British. In a sense, they're right. Israel being really just a proxy of the city of London, which has essentially been the enemy of America from the beginning. But that's the bottom line about this American system. It's really an advocacy for, as you so rightly decry, and that's the adoption of the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto, to nationalize the credit system in America. It is a trick. Would you agree, Bruce?
And as a consequence of using credit as opposed to using hard money, you can't make payment for anything. I mean, payment is the delivery of money. And if we don't have any money, then we can't pay for things. And if we can't pay for things at law, doesn't mean we can't get things. Now, obviously, the average American gets all kinds of things. When he goes to Walmart, goes to the grocery store, wherever he goes, he gets things with his debit card or with a check or with a FedNote. But getting something and paying for it are not synonymous.
In other words, you say they don't own it when they use those instruments.
Right.
Okay.
Lawful title doesn't pass to the purchaser because you're not actually doing any buying when you use a credit instrument. A credit instrument doesn't have the power to buy anything. In fact, when I had a food business back in Maine, I got rid of that business. You notice I didn't say that I sold it. I got rid of that business through a real estate company. And I was identified in the contract not as the seller but as the buyer. The guy who owned the real estate company laughed in my face uncontrollably for several seconds when I told him that he had me incorrectly listed as the seller. And he says, well, if you're not the seller, what are you? I said, I'm the buyer. He just burst out laughing. He says, you're going to have to prove that one to me. And it didn't take 2 minutes. Within 2 minutes, that man was sober. He understood what I had told him. And he says, write it into the contract. So we wrote it into the contract that I was the party who was actually paying out the assets, commodity, or property in direct proportion to its declared quantity, and I was the only party in that transaction. The other party was paying out numbers called dollars. And so I was properly identified in that contract, not as the seller, but as the buyer, with the power to buy. And the other party was identified as the seller. So you can sell a note. You can even sell a bad note, I guess. But you can't buy anything with a note. You can buy notes, you can sell notes, but you can't buy anything with a note. Now, some people will understand that quickly. Other people will have a real hard time with that. But our system is not a system of payment because there is no money with which to make payment. Our system is a system of compensatory theft. Government doesn't even pay people. People who are on the government take are receiving licenses to steal from their neighbor.
Okay, now
that's all we do is we compensate ourselves for what was stolen from us. And the longer you hang on to the instrument of confiscation, whether it be a check or a Federal Reserve note, the longer you hold on to it, the more worthless it becomes through a process of inflation because they're cranking out so many of them. And it's like a law of competitive bidding. The more there are, the cheaper they become. That's a big auction called the marketplace.
Okay. What do you think about this idea, Bruce and Melody, as a rallying cry? Shouldn't the American people, the individual living in this land that we call America, should they not be advocating for the right to not engage in organized crime?
You can't be compelled to lawfully, you can't be compelled.
Well, and it seems to me that that's precisely what we're being compelled to do every day of our lives.
Yeah,
and it begins with the money. It begins with the so-called money.
We're
practically unable to engage in honorable contract any longer. Yeah. I mean, look at this Obamacare nonsense. We may be forced to actually purchase a product that forces us into allopathic medical care. And they clearly have a long-standing program of genocide.
They're
drug peddlers.
I haven't read the bill, but it is my opinion that if one looks at all of the legislation that comes down the pike, somewhere along the line, the people who become subject to that legislation were made subject by contract. They agreed somewhere along the line.
Well, now we have our so-called representatives in government agreeing along with it. I say it again. Should we not be advocating for the right not to engage in organized crime and insist that we must engage in honorable contract? Nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah, but you also have them stating, and in a lot of instances, by you not speaking up, you have agreed just by not speaking up.
Right. Acquiescence. To acquiesce is the same as to even expressly state that you agree with.
And a lot of times you've never even heard the information to acquiesce from.
That's right. That's right. There is a tremendous amount of deception, material that is concealed from the people who are dragged into these programs, if you will. I've stated over and over in presentations and in my last book five basic maxims of law which have gotten us from where we once were to where we now are. And I believe you could go to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, for example, and you can find 40 pages of legal maxims. And maxims are extremely interesting and extremely important because they're the principles by which the whole court system, our legal apparatus, operates. And I believe that all the countries around the world, there may be an exception, but I believe even Red China operates in accordance with these maxims. And I've listed them in the order that I think they're most generally encountered. And I won't go to the Latin, which because they're Latin maxims, but I'll just read the English translation. First off, every man is presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences of his own voluntary acts. That is something that the court system will look upon. If a man has entered into a contract with a bank, with an insurance company, with a government agency, the presumption is that you intended, whatever the natural and probable consequences would be, of signing up for whatever program it was, whether it was for some sort of a tax deduction or some sort of a subsidy, whether it was welfare or whatever, you have been presumed to be subject to the consequences of what you just did, whatever they are. Secondly, he who seeks the benefit must stand to the burden. So if you don't seek a benefit, then you don't stand to the burden. Thirdly, the agreement of the parties makes the law of the contract. Fourthly, the agreement of the parties overrides the law. And this is how we got out of the common law and got into the bodies of law called equity, maritime, and admiralty. Article 6 of the Constitution provides for, I think it's Article 6, isn't it, provides for the Supreme Court, the judicial system. And
I think that's right.
The Supreme Court has jurisdiction in matters of law and equity, maritime and admiralty. Those are four bodies of jurisprudence which do not intersect, and we were born as children in the body of law called law. But when you pick up a pen at the age of what we call majority or where you can be bound by contract, when you pick up the pen and you sign your name to something, your signature creates what is called a bond of law. When you apply for a loan, a subsidy, a benefit, a privilege, privileges from the Latin privius lex means private law, you now are into private law, that law which governs you and the party who granted you whatever privilege it was. Okay? It's contract law. And fifthly, the maxims are that no injury is done by things long acquiesced in, which is what you brought up, Melody. There's a maxim of law that says if you acquiesce to it long enough, there's no injury that's been done to you. You
agree? And we were born into this system. We were all indoctrinated and enslaved into the system.
Yeah. Now, fraud vitiates contract. Okay. And so one has to be able to prove fraud. Of course, he's got to be able to do it in a court that is probably going to be a fraudulent court. it really becomes a tough nut to crack. I will concede that. But long sufferance is construed as consent. Failure to object is fatal. And silence shows consent. Those are various maxims of law. They're extremely important. That is how we lost all of our constitutional protections, whatever those might have been, that protected our common law rights, principles which I believe you can find in Scripture. There are people who might argue that you can't find them there or that they aren't as eloquently stated as I think.
But. Mm-hmm.
By the way, I want you to know that when I read about those maxims of law, and I actually heard you on another radio program recite those once before, that's when I first discovered the wisdom of Bruce G. McCarthy. Now, what I want to do, because I know we have limited time, Melody, is state for you from Bruce's book entitled Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. In a subsection entitled Nationalization, a Marxist Dream, this line, centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly is indeed the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto written by Marx and Engels. Now, here's my quick question as an aside for you, Bruce. You write another wave of Marxist reformers, and in this category, you insert the names Zarlenga and Stills et al. Now, are you referring to Bill Stills?
Yeah.
Very interesting. Did you catch that, Melody?
Uh-huh.
Marxist reformers. And, of course, you go on to mention the bill that was sponsored by Dennis Kucinich, who, by the way, is no longer in Congress. And as I mentioned earlier, if anybody that does a lick of homework would realize that his wife, his trophy wife, Italian-born lady, a redhead, I guess Dennis likes redheads, is in fact a communist. She's absolutely a communist. But is that still the title of your book, Bruce?
Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. Yeah.
That's a wonderful book. I wonder if you might provide some contact information so that anyone listening can get a hold of this book. I have to tell you, it is a wonderful book, just a wonderful book, and I especially value it because it is so concise and so sound, and it just makes so much sense. It's not confusing at all.
And if you have any other books that you've written, please mention them, let alone the fact.
I had some other books in the past. I don't have them currently in print. Solomon said, the writing of many books is endless and a weariness of the flesh. And I even hated to write this one, but I had to kind of get this one off my chest. It would have been probably easier to write a much longer book. My book, like, currently now is 104 pages long. Now, that's pretty short, but I'm trying to deal with the real world. Americans don't generally like to read anymore. In fact, I think we've got a lot of people out there who can't. I think that's one of the signs of progress in our modern educational system, is graduating as many people who can't read or don't want to. They've probably been taught to hate reading. But I've entitled the booklet or book, Lawful Money Plaintiff versus Legal Plunder Defendant. And I subtitle it, An Indictment of Criminal Fraud and Theft Perpetrated Against the Non-Bank Public by the International Banking Cartel. I've tried to keep it short. I've tried to state what I say in language that is easily understood. And I have attempted to document, generally from Federal Reserve publications, I quote rather heavily from the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve will admit what they're doing. But then, how many people out here would bother read Federal Reserve publications? And a lot of these publications probably are not available any longer. I've even written to the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland a couple of years ago, and I wanted to get a question answered, and they wouldn't even answer me. Maybe they know my name or whatever, I don't know. But I have, since 1980, been using their publications to expose what they do. I have tried to make the subject of money, banking, and credit understandable in terms of the world in which you live. And I've tried to relate it to other subjects, such as war. In fact, I even have a chapter in here called Credit in Uniform. Wars are extremely profitable for the banking system. And it doesn't take a great deal of wit to figure out that the banking systems actually foment wars. But it has color illustrations of gold coins, silver coins, copper nickel tokens. We have four pages showing Federal Reserve notes, how we transitioned from promissory Federal Reserve notes step by step to where Federal Reserve notes no longer contain the promise. Those four pages alone, my wife has said over and over and over again, if you can't show them anything, show them that. I believe that you will be able to understand this subject. In fact, there was a banker. I won't tell you where he was because he might be embarrassed. But there's a banker who told a friend of mine that he learned more in the first 15 pages of this little book than in all of the college courses that he took to become a banker.
I'm not surprised.
And I've had conversations with bankers. In fact, I've had conversations with Federal Reserve bankers. And we generally don't have any disagreements. If anybody thinks that they've heard anything that sounds a little bit off the wall tonight, bear in mind that I've sat with Federal Reserve bankers and commercial bankers and never had a disagreement with what I'm talking about. Once they understand what you know, they're forthright and forthcoming.
Bruce,
bankers are some of my best customers, you might say.
Now
the vice president of the Bank of America years ago had read my first book called "Credit Is Debt Is Slavery." He said that everything that was in that book was absolutely correct.
Wow! Now you have a radio program, Datumline, on Sunday mornings, on our Republic Broadcasting Network, which, again, Lark has his program on Saturday afternoons, and it's just a Numerican. And I'm so you can they can both be found on Republic Broadcasting Network, and our and I but Republic Broadcasting also does broadcast on certain other affiliates, so there are people that can pick it up otherwise, but that's how I pick it up.
My program is entitled Datumline. If there are any pilots in your audience, they'll recognize that. That's the reference point from which you do your weight and balance calculations, which the plural of data.
I might add that it's, the, in my view, one of the most valuable programs on RBN. And I'm very pleased that I actually am a part of the same network.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I appreciate that.
Bruce, what I wanted to come to a conclusion with here, maybe we can come to a conclusion, but okay, when you have the economic times that we're dealing with right now, and you've got this system in place, how... And would you suggest people deal with that, since it's deception, and you've got bankers that not only are taking that deception to new heights, I mean they're trying to enslave us even more with money again into future generations that cannot pay this debt, which isn't real in the first place.
What are you asking?
Okay, I'm asking you.
A remedy.
Oh, how do we get from where we are right now to where we need to be?
Yes.
Oh, well, I actually have a chapter in the book dealing with that. It's called Relief Sought by the Plaintiff. It's chapter 19. And in that chapter, I outline, and it's only an outline, a national solution. And I only do the national solution because people expect it of me. Well, how do you expect us to get out of this problem, Mr. McCarthy? You know, you get that kind of snide remark. So I lay out a program whereby you put, basically what you do is you put the banking system through a foreclosure proceeding. You hear people talk about how we need to default on our loans. No, to default on a loan suggests that you actually owed on the loan, but you were unable to fulfill your obligation. In point of fact, the Federal Reserve System has failed on its obligation because it has not put anything out there into the marketplace that constitutes a substantive loan.
Their charge was for full employment very nearly full employment and for the control of inflation, and they have failed on both counts.
Yeah, they've actually claimed to have, at one time, they claimed to have more responsibility than that. I'm going to read from a publication called The Federal Reserve at Work. Yeah, they're working on you. This is the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia. This is a 1979 publication. It says that they had four objectives: a high level of employment, stability in overall price level. Hey, we're down to the Federal Reserve note right now is worth about 3% of what it was when Federal Reserve notes first began issuing in 1914. So they've lost 97% or more of their value. And in fact, they're not worth anything. A growing economy and a sound international balance of payments. Those were the goals that they said the Federal Reserve set out to achieve. They haven't accomplished that. Anyway, in my solutions chapter called Relief Sought by the Plaintiff, I have what I call a national economic solution, and I have personal repentance highlighted because nationally America is not going to make any changes for the good. We're too far gone. But there are people out there on an individual basis who want to repent, and it's just a matter of, what is it that I need to repent of? Show me where the crime is. Show me where the sin is. Sin being transgression of the law, 1 John 3:4. It's not a bad word. And the system is sinful. No two ways about it. Violates every economic commandment of Scripture. Well, how do I stop sinning? Well, I basically lay out, in very simple terms, how you can go about doing that. I even started a trade network years ago. It was called The Pipeline. The Pipeline is actually my theme music by the Shantays on my program.
I'm so sorry we haven't been able to get into that, by the way. We need to do this again just to discuss that, Bruce. Yeah.
But we had that network running for about 10 years, during which time I didn't accept any Fed notes. I was able to survive, not comfortably, but I was able to survive without using any Fed notes for about 10 years. The network was very small, but it was a lawful trade network. It allowed people to buy and sell between each other using hard money, or if they wanted to barter wheat for lumber or whatever it was, they could. But there were no Fed notes, no checks, no debit cards, no credit cards, none of that. It was a hard money system. And you can create a hard money economy if you want to. And there are a lot of people out there who advocate for the Constitution, say they believe in the Constitution. Well, if you do, the Constitution calls for hard money. Okay? Government could operate lawfully on nothing but hard money, gold and silver. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin, a tender and payment of debts. Article 1, Section 10, Paragraph 1. Congress was given the power to coin money, not to print it, not to create it. Article 1, Section 8, and Paragraph 5. The Coinage Act established what we were going to use as money for public purposes. All public offices, all the way down to the municipal level, were required by law, and I believe still are, to keep their accounts current in money, not in legal tender, and certainly not in legal plunder. Because they abandoned the tender, they abandoned the offer back in 1963, and since then, an abandoned tender, I contend, cannot be a legal tender. But yeah, I'm kind of getting off on a little bit of a tangent there. But if anybody wants the book, I offer the book, postage is included, for $13. If you want to send silver, tell me what the exchange rate is on silver currently and send me the silver, and I'll take silver at the current exchange rate. I have no problem with that. You can order it directly from me, Bruce G. McCarthy, McCarthy. I'm at 33563. That's 33563, State Route, or Route, depending on where you're from, I guess. I'm from Maine, so I call it Route. 537, Graysville, the color gray, Graysville, Ohio, 45734. And the book's 104 pages, color photos in it. I think it's a rather neat-looking little book myself. I'm quite pleased with it. And I believe that you will, when you finish that book, you may have to read the book several times because there's not much wasted text in there. Most books will be much larger, and there's an awful lot of unnecessary fluff in most books. But I believe
that
it's pretty concise.
You have an email address, Bruce, or we can use mine either way?
I don't use email. I started to, but I really don't. I'm not comfortable with email, so...
Well, if anybody listening needs some help in acquiring Bruce's book, they can write to me via email, larkintexas@gmail.com, and I'll help you get a copy of this book because it is quite valuable to me, I must say.
You know, gentlemen, I think we've come to an end of the evening, and I've been very glad that you both were gracious enough to come on my program and inform my audience, because I think your information is invaluable and that I hope people can take it to heart and do something with it. I'm still not quite sure what we can do at this point in time, because as you said earlier, I'm not sure we can remedy it. But I don't know that we should, you know, lay down and let them, you know, just take it, anything and everything we have if possession is 9/10 of the law. I don't know.
But the remedy begins with the individual, not with we.
Okay.
Yeah, forgive me for saying so, but I'm a staunch advocate for the individual must take action.
And a trip of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. And for some people, this may be just the first step, just hearing about this. I'm sure there are a lot of questions that people are going to have in their minds. we can't cover all the bases in just 2 hours. And but I'm thankful, Melody, that you invited me on. I enjoyed it, and I hope that your listeners have found the subject matter that's been presented worthwhile.
And again, they can catch your program on Sunday mornings, Lark's on Saturday afternoons, on Republic Broadcasting. And before we end it, I just wanted to bring up again on the fact that our whole system of economy is really in a major transition, and our children who are being indoctrinated into this higher education, so-called higher education, at very high expense, really needs to be able to reevaluate the value of it and what it's going to do to them, because when it comes down to it, in the end, it may not be what you've been told it was going to be, and there may be other means to support yourself for a much more value for your efforts. Do you agree?
I agree, and I would quote a French proverb that originated back during the Reign of Terror in the late 1700s, that the guillotine follows the paper money press. The two machines are complementary, one to the other. If anybody's ever looked at the history of the French Revolution and what took place during that time, that was the consequence of a fiat system of credit that had replaced substantive money. As Voltaire had once said, all paper money reaches its ultimate value, zero. It's already lost 97% of its value since 1914. And I don't know how many of your listeners think that it will not lose the next 3%. What will they do when it is now finally worthless? And if you look at the prices at the grocery store, you will get a clue that this stuff is becoming worthless. Where are you going to get your goods and services, and how are you going to conduct your business when this stuff fails?
Okay, one other thing I can't resist asking then is the fact that if that's the case and they want to replace it with something else, do we need to realize that it isn't going to be replaced with anything better, right? Unless it's right. Hard money.
In Germany, in fact, when they had their runaway inflation in 1922-23, they actually revalorized the German notes, and you had to turn in 1 trillion. That's a capital T. T is in tango. 1 trillion Deutschmarks got you 1 Rentenmark, and you played the game over.
So it's just reshuffling the monopoly board.
Yeah, for anybody listening, if they look up counter-economics sometime in the encyclopedia, which is a term that was coined by Samuel Edward Conklin, I believe, the third, who also coined the term agorism or agorism, he basically speaks to what Bruce is speaking to here. I mean, we have to understand what it is that's important about our lives. And when this money is worthless, then do we want to be victims of the state apparatus that rounds us all up and sells us and our progeny into slavery? Or do we want to realize that we want to live our lives as free men and women with the freedom of choice, the ability to choose what's right and what's wrong, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense? And I think that there's no better advocate for what makes sense in today's world than you, Bruce.
And again, General, well, go ahead, Bruce.
Right.
Well, again, thank you, gentlemen, and good night.
Thank you, Melody. Have a good night now.
Thanks,
so long,
Melody.
Mark.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.